Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Episode 3 of Dennis Bainbridge Classic, The Iron Mark, a classic marine story. I suppose marine would be it. I would say maritime story myself. Okay, now it's a ship that had the capability, the need, everything came together, and we had the ability in Australia to manufacture these ships using all these odds, sods designs. And the main thing is the GE engine, which is basically a poor man's power station to run rubbish fuel. So in a high-performance aircraft, you need high-performance fuel, a low weight. In a power station, you can get low, you know, you can get really crap fuel, and it doesn't matter what the weight is. Ship's halfway in between. Okay, now the thing is that the thing about this is it could dock up sideways to the ship, but then it's got a sideward ramps, which is sort of almost a slipstream into it. And now, starting on page 23, only that my memory doesn't record me actually saying this. The angled navire stern ramp, number 7 of this internationally used design, used to allow loading of any conventional wharf. The ramp is 60 foot long and hinged in the middle, supported by 2 side frames. The 100-ton self-tensioning winch takes the weight of the ramp. The height of the side from the wharf is controlled by a sensor arm. An inboard side frame ramp. Hydraulic winches are mounted on the side frames to position the hinge section of the ramp that the wharf load is 5 to 10 tons. When fully loaded, the straddle truck is on the ramp. The load is 70 tons, which is evenly distributed over the wharf. Oh, there you go. So this is comes up there and it comes out, I think at the front of the boat opens up, and then coming at an angle comes to the front. The requirement for vehicle access to the ramp meant that the allocated pace for the engine room had to comply with one of two options, medium speed diesel or gas turbine. The gas turbine with superior power to weight ratio was selected based on the successful trial of the John Sargent on residual fuel. The prospect of using Gippsland waxy crude, a refinery byproduct costing $6 per ton, was also attractive. At room temperature, the oil was solidified, so it required heating up to keep it in liquid state. I'm sure I've read this before. This is a good fuel, low in vanadium. I remember that, vanadium. What the heck is it? What's the problem with the vanadium? Vanadium is in that it's scandium, titanium, vanadium. By late 66, Bob McCollum and Jim McCleach visited GE Turbine Department. On their return, the design to incorporate a gas turbine was confirmed. The Whaler Shipyard was able, in 1968, to lay out the general arrangement drawings, which incorporated the results of the various committees' findings. A more detailed proposal was developed in 1969. Bob McClellan, the shipping manager, presented the complete proposal to Sweetland. I do remember this is Rex Jones. He broke his leg skiing. So let's try to see if my memory is not working properly. An auxiliary power was provided by 3 Allen diesel sets of 265 kilovolt, 765 kilovolt amps and 1,700 kilovolt amps. These units' operations are programmed with the Siemens panels. The 165 and 2765 sets are parallel to provide the ship's base power when required, the gas turbine starting motor. The 1750 kilovolt amp is programmed to be taken offload ready for use by the bow thruster motor. During cargo operations, it is used for cargo area ventilating fans. In the 625 kilovolt unit was air-cooled and installed away from the engine room. When switched to at sea mode, the ship's power load was taken on by the shaft-driven alternator. This alternator will also double to take home motor power, but the alternator couldn't be relied on 100%, so often performed manually. The problem was thought to be a different droop characteristics between sets. However, I was told in the 80s a frequency fault was found in the control, which probably was there from the start and not found. Well, there you go. So it's got a what is it? It's got its own little power station stuff, and I do remember reading that section. The exhaust heat extraction system shown in figure 18. Heat recovery units are located to collect the heat from the port, the starboard gas turbine regenerators outlet number 1 and 2, diesel sets using the Esotherm 500 as the main heat transfer fluid. That would be really toxic, I would imagine. The system design figure 18 was for the ship's fuel water heating. The gas turbine generator exhausted at some incredible high temperature. The system's operation was automatic, with the main and peaking pumps programmed from starting and stopping the gas turbine and diesel sets. When the diesels are running, the peaking pump output is diverted through the auxiliary system supplying the fuel oil heater. Heating surfaces are calculated to be on top of the heating requirement for waxing residual oil. There was 3,300 square feet of heating surface and 3,000 tonnes of residual fuel. Oh my god. 4,000 tonnes. Oh, geez. So basically it was loaded up with pretty shitty stuff, really pretty pollutant. And it's interesting that the pollutant stuff was not switched on in port. The fresh water and cooling system is designed for cooling the gas turbine, diesel generators, air conditioning, refrigeration, ramp, hydraulic oil and heat exchanger pump gland sealers. Seawater cools fresh water in two plate heat exchangers in parallel, designed for seawater temperatures of 85 degrees Fahrenheit, freshwater outlet temperature of 95 degrees Fahrenheit. One cooler is shut off in port with the seawater temperature at 85 degrees Fahrenheit, so a satisfactory plate flow rate for the thermal duty may be obtained. Oh, well, there you go. Fuel treatment plant. The Gippsland waxy residual fuel required treatment mainly to reduce salt levels. GE published a fuel specification which is designed to provide long life to hot gas path components. This document was under constant review as the operating experience indicated a change was necessary. You can imagine this is just, you know, crap fuel. A typical system shown in figure 20 is designed to remove the soluble salt held within the residual oil. The fuel is heated to 150 degrees Fahrenheit, centrifuging and stored after washing in a clean oil tank. The emulsifier is added in the fuel before the pump heater to achieve primary mixing. Wash water then added to the mixture and emulsified. The amount of wash water is 5 to 10% of the fuel flow. The emulsifier must be carefully metered to achieve peak soluble material removal. It is predicted that 70% of salts will be removed. Oh my godfather. Oh. Go nuclear is my thing. Although the waxy residual oil is low in vanadium, provision will be made for the use of Bunker C fuel oil, which is already available in most ports. This fuel has vanadium content of 40 parts per million, which requires the addition of soluble magnesium compounds to bind with the vanadium to render it safe for turbine hot gas components. You can imagine the vanadium getting in as a getting into the turbine as a component, so increase the vanadium level of your metal. The vanadium would be the problem, is it becomes soluble in the hot metal and works your turbine. The refinery is to provide a fuel analysis of the fuel delivered to the ships holding the bunkers. This report will be the basis for the fuel washing program for the batch of that fuel. When clean, the washed fuel will be held in a holding tank that supplies the turbine. When the new batch of fuel is taken in, the analysis is, and then cleaned, it can be added to the holding tank for turbine use. No actual fuel analyzer was initially installed. So it was done before, and this is one of the things where these dick shits sack our fuel analyzers in Australia. We've got a series of fuel analyzers, and they've been bullied and sacked, and they haven't understood their importance. Manning. The ships were designed for Lloyd's Unmanned Machinery Space, UMS, and will require no engineers on watch in the engine room. With Speedtronic turbine control and the diesel operations control program integrated into the system, all control will be from the bridge. Dimensions. The ship is to be called GTV Iron Monarch, and GTV Iron Duke will have the following dimensions and capacities. Okay, I won't read that through. It doesn't actually make sense to people. So it's the length is 588 feet, whatever that means in meters, divided by 3, I suppose roughly 200 meters long. So it's sort of like will fit sort of in an oval. I think our ovals are more than that, 50-50, pretty like a football oval. The heel of the TGV Iron Monarch was laid down on June 20th, 1972, at the Whyalla Shipbuilding Engineering Works in Whyalla. What a beautiful time. A whole series of bow thrusters, deck machinery, and for some reason it's got deck machinery, Clark Chapman, emergency DC alternator. It's got DC alternators, different ones, various ones. Sounds strange. Oh, there's a 2-stroke, 4-stroke diesel alternator. They're a pretty amazing amount of equipment. Dimmitt paint system. Now, this is the paint system which meant it was a zinc-based paint, which meant it was a thing. The whole sections were treated with a Dimmitt paint system at a special facility at Whyalla Shipyard. After the sections were sandblasted, a 3-coat system was applied. When the sections were welded together, the yard painters and dockers recoated the welding areas. Later inspections of all tanks and void areas discovered any missed repair areas which required recoating. This expensive coating system would prove beneficial to the hull as its life would far exceed a non-trital. Inspections a year later would indicate no corrosion in the tanks and voids. These spaces usually fail before the rest of the vessel. Oh, there you go. BHP Project Training. Rich Joan worked out of an old home in Folly Park, which previously been the managing director's residence. The building had a faded rose appearance, and it had obviously been a fine home in its time. I always found the atmosphere relaxed with no sense of urgency. One engineering type seemed to spend most of his time asleep in one of the rooms, and I had been told he was quite brilliant. When the project received approval, the manpower was increased to 7 when Bob Moffat, mechanical, and Norm Stanley, electrical, were moved from sea duty and seconded to the Folly Park team. Bob Moffat and Norm Stanley were sent to the USA to obtain much knowledge as they could about the heavy-duty gas turbines and their systems. After the hull construction commenced, the additional personnel were seconded to Folly Park to commence training in the gas turbine system. Australian General Electric Limited, AGE. As local office of GE USA, local support would be provided by AGE. Gordon Lockhart from the Melbourne office was in the USA undergoing gas turbine training and doing installation work. I had been performing the service on the 4 bulk carriers with the central operating systems and set up a temporary system on the SS Iron Hunter after the engine room fire. Well, there you go. That's interesting. I went to the USA in 1971 to attend a gas turbine survey at the gas turbine department and saw the Iron Monarch turbine half shell on the factory floor. My only regret was that I didn't get any hands-on training on the electronic control. As usual, it would be on-the-job training or school of hard knocks. I'd been through the same COS system on steamships, and they were complex systems. I attended several meetings at the gas turbine on BHP project, how it was going to be managed. The wall was covered with flow charts and job functions and responsibilities, which I must have found too complex as I sat there transfixed. I was told not to worry, as it would work fine. Wayne Adams had been appointed to the head of the installation's Whyalla. Later, I travelled to Drive Systems Department, Salem, Connecticut, VA, whatever that is, and took the COS systems for the RoRo vessels, whatever they are. System used skinny scanner for monitoring gearbox and shaft bearings. Point switching was solid state, a vast improvement on the old COS relay switching. It was quite different from the steamship systems. There was no engine order telegraph, as these ships were controlled from the bridge. Alarms were divided into vital and non-vital and were switched through the duty engineer's cabin. All pumps were controlled from the panel. While I was there, I followed the replacement of the cost patterns in panels in the SS Hunter. Through final tests, the panel was later installed at the State Dockyard, Newcastle. What I think is rather interesting is that solid state was coming out then, and this is a pre-solid state. I suppose it was solid state. No, the diode. What is the diode solid state? I don't know. It's hard to imagine a glass diode inside. So this is sort of pretty, almost digital stuff. The turbine of the Iron Monarch shipped from the gas turbine department in June 72, the same month as with the keel laid in Whyalla. Looking at the turbine module in figure 2, 21, right outside the inlet duct, which receives filtered air from the air inlet demister house in the upper deck. In the centre can be seen the combustion wrapper flange connection and the compressor outlet, throttle regenerator and charge connection of the heated return air from the generator to the combustion chamber. This is duplicated on the other side of the turbine. At the left hand end is the side exhaust duct where the hot exhaust air is ducted to the starboard regenerator, which is on the duplicated on the port side. It can be seen how modular the gas turbine package was when coupled to the accessory base, made an easy engine to install. So it is dropped in the engine, part of World War II thing. Here's the Iron Monarch launched in 73. The Iron Monarch was launched in February 1973 by Lady McNeil, wife of BHP director Sir James McNeil. The fitting out stage could now begin. She's got a whole series of, here's different P's, the USA, the AGE people, BHP team, Whyalla, all different people. Dennis Bainbridge was the COS person at AGE Sydney. The engines had a stroke of luck when the turbine was opened up to change the HP wheel cover plates to UDMET 500 materials, which was better suited to protect the first stage bucket root area from gas heat. This normally meant fitting the turbine casing to remove twist locks holding the cover plates in place. Removing them, reinstalling the new cover plates and twist locks. It was decided to test the ability to strip the turbine down to its half shell and stow the casings on special staging installed in the engine room. The exercise proved that lifting gear supplied coupled with the staging that the turbine could be dismantled to perform a maintenance required in the future. This experience proved invaluable later when the turbine required its first major inspection at the Cairns Cross Deck in 1976. The deck officers were able to get some hands-on experience with the straddle trucks on the steel mill wharf running over a temporary ramp. Later they were able to operate the cranes while operating manuals of stevedores, devise a bay identification system and mark crane alignment guides arrows on the crane rail beams. Also they devised sea securement systems and rather optimistically hoped that they had set up a foolproof operation plan. Have they? In August 13th, 1973, a turbine started for the first time and the dock trials commenced, with the turbine load coupling disconnected. After all tests, including overspeed systems, were completed, the load was connected. The CPP propeller wouldn't work correctly, so the CE consultant had to look at that and said the oil supply part was too small. The young people were not convinced, so he went away and did some calculations, came back. Said you need this size of pipe. That night the pipe was replaced the next day, it all worked. Well, there you go. Here's a cult photograph. The bridge console, figure 23, was simple with the engine control on the right hand side, propulsion levers controlling the power and pitch and the docking maneuver modules. On the left lever is the pitch position meter. In front of the lever was the indicator meter, which was rotating the propeller. Started spinning when the propeller, remember the variable pitch propellers, commenced spinning. Control location transferred to the bridge room, switch lights, a bridge lamp and sound buzzer. Shaft brake switch is located at the console. When set, the HP turbine runs at low idle speed, and when released, HP turbine runs up to high idle. Steering motor control switches were provided to select port and starboard motor, or both. An emergency stop push button was provided. A sound telephone connects the engine room. The left-hand side contained Decker Akos autopilot system. The heading was set on the dial. The system clutched to manual or auto. In emergency, the auto system could be bypassed by using the port and starboard override lever. The main lever is the ship's wheel or helm. In figure 24, the speedtronic valve was left with meters for HP and LP speed, exhaust temperature, large universal temperature meter, VCE fuel, NCE, second gauge, nozzle. The center panel contains the skinny bearing temperature scanner, which scans the transmission bearings and alarms over temperature conditions. Two vertical meters were from the bridge propulsion lever position propeller pitch. The right side panel pump selector switches control the logic. Figure 25, the rear of the gas turbine cubicle is shown, and the side exhaust dust feeding the exhaust air and regenerators drive the turbine passes through the standard GE double reduction dual torque path articulated design gearbox. Well, there you go. Isn't that amazing? Oh, God. I'm surprised no one got killed building this. Drivers, a 500 kilowatt shaft alternator which can serve to take home 600 bhp motor powered diesel sets. The shaft disc brake assembly is mounted and the second reduction gear pinion assembly. An ASE torductor was fitted on the shaft. Large support required for the regenerators can be seen in figure 26 with a view of the starboard structure. Well, there you go. It's amazing. And the Yanks have the US things. Now, what is a RORO loading system? I don't quite understand that. RORO handling, chapter 4. RORO cargo handling equipment. As described earlier, these vessels were designed by Whaler Shipyard in conjunction with BHP Planning and Development Section. The planned systems were to transport steel products around Australia in competition with the current shipping methods and rail. It was a move to put pressure on the government-controlled railways to contain freight rates. Oh, well, there you go. Isn't that amazing? So really, they had... it's amazing. So this was... is not necessarily, its value would be to push down, that's amazing, push down the rate of freight. Well, there you go. The proposal to build two fast ships to be integrated into the total material handling system, ships were to be RORO types with an angled nav stern ramp for ease of loading and unloading the vehicle deck with straddle trucks. The lower deck contains special cells where the steel carrying bolsters can be stacked 6 high. Then the cells are full, additional bolsters can then be stacked 3 high on the vehicle deck. Looking at the system in detail in figure 28 indicates the thought that went into the total package. The straddle truck with the bolster steels enters the vehicle deck via the nav ramp, which lowers the bolsters onto the deck to be picked up by the gantry crane, which travels to the cryo hold and lowers the bolsters to the hold. When the holds are full, the bolsters are stacked in the vehicle deck. Rows of ventilation fans maintain a clean environment in the vehicle deck. Individual fans can be set to the intake exhaust and used in conjunction with wind conditions. Frequent atmosphere changes in the vehicle deck. Exhaust gases are never a problem. Okay, so this is a problem you can imagine. The confined space would be ugh. They carry steel products. 2,500 Austin, 550 steel products, special bolsters were manufactured and were the same dimensions as the ISO half-height containers, 20 by 80 by 8 by 4 feet. This standard B-type bolster for carrying steel products with drop ends to allow loading of longer products were required. Apertures forklift tyres were on each removable side piece. The bolster could be covered by a tarpaulin to protect the steel from the elements. These bolsters were a tier rate of 3.5 tonnes and could hold 26 tonnes of product. Well, there you go. This is great stuff. A bolster is basically a box for carrying 10 feet wide steel plate to the whaler shipyard. The bolster type A was used, and which was 13 by 10 by 2.5 feet vehicle deck use only. These bolsters had the same mounting feet to match the floor locking apertures, which could be stowed 5 high. So you can imagine this is a stocking system. Also from Whaler Works, along the product's manly universal beams could be loaded into open-ended stand bolsters for vehicle deck loading only. With such a long overhang, the straddle trucks had to be kept level to prevent ends digging into the ramp wharf holding out. Okay, so these little trucks would flip either side. The tide had to be right and the ramp frequently tended to ensure to be straight, excellent entry. Straddles could assist in lifting the bolster to the maximum height. The drawing, Figure 29, shows the cell guides that use the lower deck to hold the bolsters 6 level high. When the steel cells were loaded, large pontoons were used to seal the cells and provide a floor for the vehicle deck. The vehicle deck pontoon lids have recessed apertures 3 inches deep where the bolster's feet sit and hold position. Bolsters are then stacked on top of 3 bolsters high. The second and third level bolster's feet sit in an aperture on top of the lower bolster. Imagine this is all done in Korea with a flick of a button. There were 30-ton gantry cranes running the length of the ship at the speed of 200 fpm, whatever that means, feet per minute, with a hoisting speed of 60 feet per minute. The crane had a spreader which was lifted with 2 hydraulic cylinders connected to the push rods to operate twist locks. The spreader was dropped onto a low bolster, so the twist locks entered the aperture, and the twist locks were rotated by hydraulics to allow the bolster to be raised and released when the bolster is lowered in position. Wow, I sort of understand this. So this is basically, it's got a crane of these bolsters, which are open-ended boxes, just come in. Cargo deck arrangements, page 45. The cargo deck space was divided into 6 rows, with 1 crane servicing 2 rows. The rows were numbered from the port side, looking forward. Each row had 2 deck levels, the lower holds and a vehicle deck. There were 6 holds, with number 1 being the forward hold. Each of the first 5 holds contained 3 bays, while hold number 6 contained 1 bay. Figure 20, or in brackets 20. Hold 1 was central only, and there was insufficient ship beam to accommodate a port and starboard hold. So you can imagine it's going up to the pointy end of the ship. But it's this is a massive, massive ship. My God, Father. Seeing it go in, and this would be a twinkle of the eye. It's a big thing with Australia. The Americans would just produce this without thinking. The bolster capacity for all type B was 308 to hold in the holds and 225 in the vehicle deck for a total of combined, if you can add it up, it doesn't make sense. Oh, yes, 533. To identify a bolster location at code 15.4.04.06, we'll identify the bolster and the bay 15, row 4 and 6 level bolster for maximum hull depth. Not all bay cells were 6 levels deep, as certain tanks and hull shapes determine the depth of that position. Each cell contained an angle section guide spaced 20 times 8 feet to hold the bolster in position. The bolsters sit on top of the lower bolster, its 4 shoes fitting into the shoe housing apertures in the lower bolster. They are firmly locked into position. Bolsters is a 1970s term, because we had bolsters was the idea for long furniture, long guidey thing. We called bolsters in the 70s. Once filled, the cells were filled in each hold. The hold is sealed with a pontoon. The pontoons were very deep beams, approximately 1 meter deep, heavily plated, and covered 1 cargo hold. There were 5 in rows 1, 5, and 6, and 6 in the center rows 3 and 4. The largest of these 3 bolsters length by 2 wide and weight up to 27 tons. They had angle edges and dropped into the hatch combinings, while the wedge stopper, although they didn't have to be watertight. In fact, if a failure of the stern door ever occurred, it's preferable that any inrush of water be allowed to flow into the lower holds to prevent dangerous free surface effect on an extremely beamy vehicle deck. The downfall of numerous vehicle deck vessels is, and sometimes terminal, so it sinks from the bottom. So I sort of can understand that. The pontoons had an aperture hole in their top surface space, 20 by 8 feet, to locate the vehicle desk bolsters' shoes. The Type B bolsters were loaded 3 high on the vehicle desk, and Type A were loaded 5 high on the vehicle desk. As there was generous clearance between the diameters of the bolster shoe and the aperture recess, Peter Buchan noted that in a rough sea it was scary to see the... I can imagine it. See the what? Oh, you see the bolsters sliding about, even though only by half an inch sideways. He initially feared the stow may topple, but he found no indication that the bolster shoes leaving their apertures and the bolsters capsizing. You can imagine that. But there's a fair number of tons holding it down, mate. Oh my god, father. This is sort of like big, heavy. You can see this, you know, huge crane equipment. Each ship had 30-ton cranes, which were built by Deer Park Engineering with the Siemens Electrics. There were 4 hoist wires which connected the 4 wheels on the spreader. The crane control cab was in the centre with a glass floor to allow the operator to have a clear view of the spreader operation. The crane hoisting speed was 60 feet per minute, and the transverse speed was 200 feet per minute, giving a total transverse time of 15 seconds. So these were bloody fast. You can imagine these would be just like, it's like even my modern standards. The spreader was designed to drop on the bolster, so its 4 twist locks centered apertures to the bolster. When loaded, the twist locks were rotated 90 degrees by the... Oh, God, we'll read this up to chapter 5. A hook system to allow the bolster to be raised. Normally 8 feet spreader had the ability to open to 10 feet wide to handle the plate cargo. Its onboard hydraulic system performed these functions using cylinders forward and aft operated by 2 push rods, each rotated the twist rods. Safety interlocks prevent twist rods operation if loaded. Howard Cooper from Deer Park Engineering worked out that left-hand lay wires on the left-hand helix winch drum and vice versa on the right-hand drums ensured spreader bias was minimal. Can you imagine that? With a large bias difficulty arose landing twist locks into slots. We frequently had to adjust the crane purchase anchor to help to remove the spreader base caused by the wire stretch. There were many early problems operating the cranes with inexperienced workers who found it difficult to locate the spreader correctly and engage twist locks. Forward and aft travel were very accurately aligned by crane cab mark on the orange arrows which at each bay. Thwart ship travel by means of the driver who had understood vision of the spreader top, bringing it over the bolster, lowering it down until it touched, then wiggling a touch until the twist lock dropped into their receptacles. Flippers were often used to assist the twist lock location. There was endless problems getting some drivers to learn this technique. They also dropped the bolsters at full speed instead of designed creep speed. This rough handling caused many hydraulic problems with burst hoses leaking cylinder seals. It took some time before operators learnt to use the cranes correctly. It must be acknowledged that the cranes moving inside the vessel cargo space were a very new concept. The problem of stowing the cranes for sea was initially to be done using chain lashing. This was considered dangerous near live crane rails and was finally solved by welding angle L sections to support beam at the forward end of the vessel, producing lugs of the hydraulic underside of the crane. were thus locked from movement when the cranes were driven right forward against the head buffer, thus preventing the crane from jumping off the tracks in heavy seas or swells. Heavy turnbuckles screwed home hard torqued the crane against the buffers while in sea storage. The only crane problem at sea occurred some 2 years later when swaged ends of the crane purchase wires began to fail. This was due to the spreaders, although always heaved up to full extent of the crane hoist at sea storage, there was always some sideways sway at sea. Boulevard examined the failed swages and advised it was the fatigue fracture due to constant flexing. The ship solved the problem by placing a shackle between the swage eye and connecting the lugs underside the crane frame. This 90-degree rotation changed the sway from the thwart strip to the fore and aft direction. In this plane spreader movement, Selborne happened. The cranes were in constant learning cycle for the officers, crew and shore workers. Great assistance was provided by Howard Cooper from Deer Park Engineering and Bob Russell from Siemens. These two smart engineer designers stuck with the project until all problems were solved, possibly with a view to further crane orders as container revolution was in full stride and every port in Australia was planning a container cranes. Oh, there you go. The loading usually started forward. The crane operators were liable to forget a platoon was on the deck and if a bolster was not raised at least 1 metre higher than vehicle deck, it would strike any open pontoon between the crane and the stern door. For this reason, the removed pontoons were placed forward of the working hold whenever possible. Many of these problems and solutions still apply to slab-carrying iron monarch. Okay. That's up to chapter page 51, if I can remember that. And the Iron Monarch is a pretty amazing thing. Beyond me, it's just an amazing ship. Let's see. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.